This episode is brought to you by Thorne, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorne is now offering you an ongoing 35% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorne is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorne.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorne. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorne, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show Army Reservist veteran, former Chinook crew chief, TBI survivor, and the founder of Handicapping, Zeke Crozier. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from his journey into the reserves, responding to the earthquake in Pakistan, his deployments in Afghanistan, Uganda, his near-fatal injuries in a helicopter crash, Extortion 17, therapy through art, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of over 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Zeke Crozier. Enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Thorne, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorne is now offering you an ongoing 35% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorne is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorne.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorne. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorne, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show Army Reservist veteran, former Chinook crew chief, TBI survivor, and the founder of Handicapping, Zeke Crozier. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from his journey into the reserves, responding to the earthquake in Pakistan, his deployments in Afghanistan, Uganda, his near-fatal injuries in a helicopter crash, Extortion 17, therapy through art, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of over 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Zeke Crozier. Enjoy. Well, Zeke, I want to start by saying thank you so much for taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Yeah, James, thanks for having me on here, man. We've been connected for how long, man? A long time, right?
On social media, yeah.
Yes, sir. So never officially met, I don't believe, but it's nice to be on here. Thanks for having me on here.
So where are we finding you on planet Earth today?
I'm in Florida, Bradenton, Florida, currently. I've been here for a little over 2 years. Made it through these hurricanes, man. Hopefully we're done for the season.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, so you were closer to, which one came across? Was it Helene? No, Milton that came across by you, didn't it?
Milton, yeah, we were right in the eye of it.
Yeah.
It came clear. Nailed us, for sure.
Did you do okay, though?
Yeah, considering how others, you know, were impacted, I think we're pretty blessed. Just small repairs to the house. The truck obviously got tore up, but those things are replaceable. So other than that, we're good.
Absolutely. Yeah, a friend of mine lives in Indian River, and they had tornadoes spin off the hurricane, and that decimated his area. So that's the thing, I think, with some of these hurricanes, if you're not right by the ocean, sometimes a hurricane itself can be okay, but it's the tornadoes that do the real damage.
Oh, yeah, there were a significant amount of tornadoes this go around, especially on the other side of Florida. I mean, they got hit real hard with those things. So I'm from the Midwest, though. I mean, I'm from Kansas and Missouri. So I feel like I can deal with tornadoes. I'm familiar with them anyway. You throw in water in there and all of a sudden I'm not good at that kind of stuff. But that's part of Florida.
Well, there's no basements to hide in Florida either.
Exactly. That's my thing. Man, give me somewhere to hide.
All right, well, let's start at the very beginning of your timeline then. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
Sure. So I was born and raised in Kansas City, Kansas, so KU Medical Center. I was number two in line of four brothers, so I was the second oldest. From that point, we moved out to, you know, to Missouri. I lived in a very, very small town. And when I say small town, Mount Moriah. So if anybody's familiar with Bethany, Missouri, it's I-35 north from Kansas City. And so that was fairly small at the time too. But so east of Bethany, a place called Mount Moriah, population was 45 when I lived there. I went back about 3 or 4 years ago, actually, and to relocate it, show my youngest son the area. And I took a picture next to a sign that says 89 now. So it's doubled in size over, 20 years. But that's where I gained my values. I feel like being an independent individual, overcoming things, adversity within myself, not expecting anybody else to save the day, you know. So with four brothers, and my older brother was a Marine, and I kind of followed his footsteps. I wanted to be a Marine, but they couldn't guarantee me a position. And so I went to the Army side, and if I get ahead of you, let me know, because I'm just going along with the flow. But if I didn't
I'll pull you back to your childhood. I'd like to spend a little bit of time there. So firstly, population of 45, the phrase, yeah, it takes a village, I think is something that we've kind of got away from, especially in suburban and urban areas where there's, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of us, yet we're not always connected. So, you know, the old school tribe and then the historic, you know, village, whether it is in the UK or here in the US, that community was very important. With a population of 45, what was that community element in your town?
Very small. You know, the cool thing was, and I, again, it's like a dream. It's been, 35 years ago. So it's been a long time. And of course, I got hit in the head too, so my memory's not the greatest. But I do recall, just by looking at pictures, it kind of brings it back for me. And I do recall just being so independent and reliant on no one, really just yourself and the, you know, what's around you, things like that. But a typical, like, you can make a walk to the neighbor's house and they just drop everything to help you, get you the shirt off your back. That's what it is. It was a community that you may not see this person or talk to this person, just having that, everybody like came together and helped each other, you know, but you were just self-reliant and hardworking. There were no excuses. You didn't have any excuses. Who are you going to complain to, right? So I remember growing up like that. We had, to go pick weeds all the time. We had a garden. We had one cow in our backyard. We had pigs, chickens, things like that. So you knew what you had. There was a structured environment. You knew what you were waking up to do. And there wasn't about, what am I going to get to go do? What kind of fun things am I going to go experience today? It was just the necessities, like what was necessary to survive. That's what it was all about. And I don't recall any like fighting, arguing, nothing like that with neighbors, individuals. I don't recall that growing up anyway. So I just, to me, it's survival at its best is what it was.
What were your parents doing profession-wise?
So my parents were never married. So my dad lived in Kansas City. My mom was remarried and my mom worked on a pig farm. I just watched her work so hard to provide. And so she did it. She had a computer desk, and then, you know, to make more money, she went and worked at a pig farm where she would come home just a mess, a wreck, because she would have to like kill pigs that came out that weren't, you know, properly, like some had their head was twisted or whatever, their body wasn't, they needed to be, you know, taken out. So she'd have to, I remember she would say she had to take it by the feet and slap their heads down. Like, man, this is so graphic, just the way she would explain it. But just watching my mom work her ass off, essentially, it was inspirational just to watch that. And then her husband at the time, he was a school bus driver / mechanic. And so, he was also a Marine earlier in his time as well. So, maybe that was the inspiration for me as well, watching that, but just seeing that if things had to get accomplished, you weren't going to rely on anybody else. It all came within.
What about sports and exercise? What were you playing and doing back then?
I played baseball. I didn't get to play baseball at a young age, but I did get to start when I was sixth and seventh grade. I played baseball, and I was really good. I didn't know that until there was a scout that picked me up and came and sat down. I remember him coming and sitting down with my mom and my stepdad, saying, "This guy's good. We wanted to be on our traveling team, but my parents couldn't afford it." And so with anything, I liked other sports too, but being told that, hey, you're good at this, you should, you know, continue this. And that's what I did. So I played a lot of baseball as a left-handed pitcher. I had a really good arm. And my older brother didn't play sports and my younger two brothers didn't play sports at the time. So I was just the only guy playing sports. But I really enjoyed baseball.
What about career aspirations? What were you dreaming of becoming when you were in the high school age?
I did like art. And I knew business was necessary as well. But growing up, I was really in tune with architectural engineering. Like the models of the stadiums or larger buildings, they would have on display. You'd see those. I wanted to build those. I liked how intricate and detailed they were. And I got to use my hands and then the creative part of your mind going along with that.
I know you went into the military after 9/11. So how old were you when that happened? And then talk to me about that day through your eyes.
So I was a junior in high school. I was actually at gym, I believe, when that happened, and they all set us down and announced that. And then I had already been working a couple of years now. My mom and that man that she was married to got a divorce in my freshman year in high school. And all I knew is I went into like a survival mode again, right? My mom was depressed, couldn't work, couldn't provide, and they were getting a divorce. And so she took off, and I went with her, and she couldn't pay the bills. So I went to work. I worked at a Sonic, and I worked at doing flat work. And so I worked my tail off while going to school, all through high school. And so I started paying all the bills. My mom couldn't do it, so I was paying all the bills, which, granted, the money went a lot farther at that time, and you could get a nice small apartment, and it wasn't a big deal. So still, I was doing that. Junior in high school at this point, and I'm watching this, and I'm like, I want to join the military. I want to take care of this, and serve my country and do what I can to protect those things right there. But bring me back in, James. I lose my train of thought when I start rolling like that. I'm very honest about it. It happens. It's hard for me to stay on track like this for too long.
No problem at all. Not an issue. So you're working, as you're going through high school. What impact, what do you remember of that day? And then you mentioned about the military. So let's start with that first. So talk to me about watching, what unfolded on 9/11, and then how that kind of sowed a seed for your military career.
Sure. Thank you for doing that. Watching it, hearing that on, at school, going home, sitting in there in front of the TV and watching this. I know they talked about people that were diagnosed with PTSD and had mental health struggles just watching this on TV. You know what I mean? It's definitely guarded nowadays, I think, to some extent, but just watching all that, it just made me, angry, but I wanted to do something about it. But I talked about working at Sonic. I went to Sonic later that evening, and I remember sitting there at work. No one was coming in to work, just looking outside and watching the long, miles of cars waiting in line for fuel to get somewhere. It was chaotic. And that, I think all of that brought inspiration to me of like, hey, I need to, this is my duty. This is my, and just talking to other people, hearing these things, knowing my brother was going off to be a Marine to protect our country, defend, just the unity involved with all of that was absolutely inspirational. And that's what, those are all different things I felt at that moment amongst that I can recall right now anyway.
So was it after graduation that you had your kids initially?
So yes. So I graduated at 17 years old. And obviously I had already learned that I could take care of bills, work, provide, be independent. My mom had moved on at that point with the guy that I set her up with, which they're still together to this day. So I feel pretty good about that one. Right. And I went and got an apartment on my own at 17 years old. I was turning 18 in July after graduating. So I was able to use my cell phone as my credit. They allowed that. And, I got myself an apartment, started working again. I had a couple different jobs for the apartment, tried to go to school. I'd go to school first thing in the morning. I was working overnight. And then I had my oldest child was born, when I was 18, almost 19. And so at that time, once that happened, I was like, you know what? I have a duty at this point and responsibility on top of what I want to do with my country is also take care of my son. And so that's what pushed me. And I was like, this is, I need to do this. I need to go enlist. I need to go find my way in the military so that, I have a guaranteed, taking care of my responsibilities. And like I said, I went to talk to a Marine recruiter because that's all I knew at the time, right? That's all I knew was my brother and how he went through that. And I was like, I want to do this. And then I was like, I feel like there's more I can do here. And so nothing against the Marine Corps, by the way, just at that time, I didn't want to be a grunt essentially. And I was like, So I wanted to see what the Army could offer. I did. I scored very high on the ASVAB, and they said, "Do whatever you want to do." I said, "Well, teach me. I don't know what to do." And they said, "Well, there's actually close to here. There's an aviation unit. It's a reserve unit, but there's an aviation unit. You can, you know, serve, but also be close to your son." And so I was like, "This is genius." So it wasn't active duty, which I had been, you know, that was what I wanted to do. But going there, I could always process, you know, move. I could, you know, cross over and go the active duty route at a later time. So I went to the reserve unit, the aviation unit in Gardner, Kansas.
I mean, that's why I asked about your son initially, because I saw the documentary. I forget where I saw it now, but there's a great 40-minute piece on you. But I think that's admirable. Yes. You know, you want to serve, but you don't want to be at the expense of not being a present father. So you found that Army Reserve unit close to yourself.
Yes, sir. Thanks for watching it, by the way. Yeah, patriotfeatures.org. That's a Kansas City local. One individual. And he does all of that, and it's amazing. And he does it, you know, he puts out stories in documentaries like that. But thanks for watching that, James. And so, you know, the funny thing with recruiters too is like they were saying like, this unit hasn't been deployed in years. And, 6 months after I'm home from, you know, basic and AIT, Pakistan has an earthquake and we're deployed for the earthquake relief, which is a documentary on PBS called Kansas to Kandahar. And that was that humanitarian mission to Pakistan. And so I was deployed, you know, wheels up to Pakistan. And from there, we went directly into Afghanistan for a full year tour.
Well, let's talk about Pakistan first, because I saw that. What were you faced with? I mean, there's a lot of people from Pakistan in the UK, you know, Pakistani, English, I guess you'd say, or British, I don't know what the term would be, but a lot of families from India, Pakistan, that area, again, it goes back to the empire. And so, you know, I grew up around those cultures, but what did you see as far as the country itself and the devastation from that particular earthquake?
You know, and I was brand new in the military too. So this was all new to me and just experiencing and just witnessing these types of devastation firsthand. And we got to be, we hung out in the same hangar with the Australians, the Aussies. I got to connect with them and learn their, you know, those kind of individuals, amazing human beings, by the way. It's fun to learn different heritages in different areas of the world. And it was cool to experience that. But Pakistan was kind of nerve wracking. It was a humanitarian mission, so we had no weapons. The weapons were locked up. And then there's a lot of propaganda going on around that time. This was 2005, I believe, 2005, late 2005. And so whatever was going around, like newspapers, propaganda was going on. These guys were trying to storm the front gates to come on. And we're sitting there going like, we're stuck in a hangar in Qasim. And we still had to go back in through town, in the little vehicles to go, you know, pick up go through the connexes, from the ships that brought over our things and, the equipment, things like that. And so, I have pictures, and forgive me, because the hard thing about this, my memory is recalling the things that I experienced and went through. So thankfully I have documentaries, pictures, videos, people that can help me with remembering these things. But for myself, it's difficult to retrieve all these things from my mind. But I do recall being pulled over, and when being in Pakistan, it's not like you have cops following you around saying you're a speed limit. They'd have locals in the middle of the street with whistles, you know, with wearing their uniforms, and they'd wave you down. They'd wave you down and say, you know, you're speeding, and so you'd have to pull over. And our driver was speeding, and he got pulled over. And then we have, and you have our bus, our small bus is full of guys in uniforms, guys and girls in uniforms. And so all of a sudden, as soon as they figure out that there's people, or there's military uniforms, U.S. military uniforms, now all the community, the people, the crowds start coming around the bus. And so I remember one of our guys, the officer had a bag full of cash, and he had to pay the guy to let us go, basically move forward, whatever it takes to get going. So that was nerve wracking for me, being a young American soldier and experiencing those. I think I was 20 or 21 at the time. I think 20 actually. So just nerve wracking. And just to see the different environments, driving on the streets and looking outside, like you got pigs, hogs hanging upside down. I'm sure this is normal in a third world country, but for me, being a young individual, to experience it was different.
What do you remember, if anything, about rescues during that time? Because I think, you know, when we talk about the military, and obviously we'll get to Afghanistan in a minute, when it comes to reporting, obviously the focus is on combat. But as I've learned now from, you know, over 1,000 interviews, there's so much kindness and compassion that happens through our military members. So with that earthquake response, do you remember any kind of rescues or moments of kindness and compassion on that part?
I do. I remember seeing pictures and videos. For me, so I went in as a 15 uniform. I was a mechanic. So my time in Pakistan was spent back and forth working on, you know, building up the aircraft or building up, you know, any kind of equipment. And then being back at the at Qasim, at the hangar, at the base there, and just building. So I got to watch them leave, and then I would see them come back, and I would see pictures and videos. And so just watching and seeing, like, just the so many different, you know, videos and of people that are happy and, like, shocked, like, this is Americans. And so everybody, you'd see all these guys waving when our, you know, our choppers would come in, and they'd be hovering, dropping water, pallets of water and food and these things. And you see all these locals just, like, running over to hug, and almost dangerous, because the front of the hangar or the front of the rotor wash, the blades being that low could tear people up. So just watching those things and seeing that again, I'm going to use the documentary again. I'm actually in it a few times. I don't recognize myself very well, but just witnessing all those, you know, what's going on, and the feedback, and feeling like you're making a difference, right? That's what we all, I think that's where we get our cup filled with everything, is seeing it and believing that you're making a difference in some way. I mean, I don't remember it exact. Again, this is what's hard for me, is getting hit in the head sucks. I don't remember an exact moment, because I didn't live that moment. Essentially, I got to witness the after effects of, you know, after our guys would go out there and fly and drop these things down. So, but I'm proud to be a part of it. Right. I'm proud to be, to know that I was taking care of, I was maintaining the helicopters and doing my part within that mission.
See, that there's such a kind of duality to that, because when I've had people on that have talked a lot about the Taliban, Afghanistan, even, you know, Afghan natives on the show, they talk about how a lot of the Taliban actually began in Pakistan. And that's where a lot of the fighters would go back over the border. So you've got these U.S. soldiers in the middle of this conflict who are helping the Pakistani people. Whilst on the border, those are the same combatants that you're fighting.
Yeah, that was looking back, it's kind of nerve-wracking to know that we were there. But we had heard that before, that's where bin Laden was at. I was part of the VIP mission. Afterwards, I went back to the embassy to, like, celebrate. Again, I don't recall exactly. I just have vivid, you know, memories of all those things. This has been years ago, too. But yeah, I mean, that's to know who's good and who's bad, and who are you talking to, who are you around. And we learned that firsthand moving back, you know, moving into Afghanistan and watching guys that locals were there that were picked up to be brought on base, and those guys were actually communicating outside. So it's you know, you never know who's right, who's wrong, who's good, who's bad, and that we just followed orders. That's all I remember doing, giving us all to do. You know,
so what do you remember about Afghanistan? Like you said, obviously you're on the the mechanic side. You're servicing all these imperative modes of transport for our military. That first deployment to Afghanistan, what were the kind of notable memories for you?
So I remember it was somewhat cold. It was like we arrived there in the winter, the cold time, I guess, is what it's called. We were between Bagram, and then we moved. I was in Kandahar most of that deployment. It was at 06 to 05 to 06. We were under 10th Mountain, 210 or 310. I don't recall. But just Kandahar being, you know, we were, you know, IDF constantly. I became part of the QRF for on the maintenance side. It became the same thing every day, just walking. I remember we lived next to the ship pond, And then just walking through that, the smell, we'd walk outside after showering and just the wind would blow and be stuck with all this sand and shit. Constant ticks going on, not sleeping well. I know we got hit right next to our building, and I'm trying to put all this into words is difficult. I just know that I got thrown, a bunch of all of us, our entire building got thrown because of a mortar that hit, you know, maybe what, 50 yards from us, just going out, just looking at it when, where that hit, and knowing we had guys and girls taken out constantly from that kind of stuff. And it's, I mean, it was scary. I had issues after that first one, just from the stuff, just from witnessing those things so close hand. And I don't know how to put it in words, James. It's like, I have a difficult time, I guess. I've never really processed what I experienced there. I really only think about what I experienced on my next appointment, and that's what's made me who I am today. So I guess hopefully people that are watching this see the struggle I'm having with putting this into words, and once they find out like what happened to me, maybe it'll make more sense. It's not that I'm an idiot, that I didn't experience these things, right? It's a matter of I have a hard time getting it out and putting it into words. It's just very difficult. Yeah.
No, you're one of many people that have had massive TBIs, and one of them, Joe Lowry, who's a Green Beret. You mentioned 10th Mountain. I forget which group he was a part of, but I mean, he was a massive, massive TBI, you know? And so, yeah, I think people need to hear this. This is the impact. And as I know you talk about, and we'll get to, you know, when you have a head injury and you look okay and you've got all your limbs, you know, people are kind of like, oh, well, he's fine. But obviously, yeah, whether it's a physiological impact from a helicopter crash or whether it's a psychological impact from being mortared and, you know, having sand and shit sprayed all over you and three of your people are blown up, whatever happened, I mean, that's a big part too. And it's funny because you said about the next deployment. Well, we're a sum total of all the things. So the inability to remember some of that stuff that happened is probably also a challenge for healing, because some of that stuff probably does need to be addressed as well.
Right. And that's part of therapy and going through the process, right? I'm only focused on what I think is my problem and things that, but when you have multiple scenarios and situations that you've had to endure and go through, it's something I may not even be aware of that affected me in my first deployment, you know? Just the reality of it all. Maybe being away from my son at the same time, you know what I mean? Like, there's just a lot that goes on, and just trying to make sense of it all. We were very blessed though on that first deployment, even under I want to say it was 310, which either one, it was 210, 310. And then the next deployment was the opposite. But we had an amazing, you know, deployment with no significant, no, we didn't lose anybody essentially. Right. We had, you know, safety was amazing. We had no accidents, things like that. So it was almost like looking back, it was almost like a cool experience to know that it was a good, positive, impactful deployment, and that I got to be part of that and just see the success part of it. All the cool pictures and videos we have, just watching all of our aircraft, multiple together, up and flying. I wish I had pictures to send you, just experiencing things like sandstorms, right? Once I got to fly my next deployment, I got to be above those and look at them from the air. But when I was there on the first deployment, I've got a picture of you can see the line of Chinooks that are like out there, and they have a picture of me running out to one of the aircraft to close it up real quick, because you see the sandstorm slowly coming in and creeping in, and that's an insane experience right there, you know what I mean? Just living inside of that for a moment and then having a picture to capture that on top of it. So yeah, just living on a flight line like I did. Again, I don't speak the language anymore. And then on top of that, the things that I lost from that, but man, I did it. I did it. And there's evidence of it all. And that helps me feel better about it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Well, speaking about, you know, interesting deployments, talk to me about Uganda.
I thought I was going to die. Of all places, I thought I would die in Uganda, Africa. And I say that because awesome experience again, to go to a zoo essentially, and all that divides you between like a lion is a chain link fence. I'm lucky to be alive in that experience because I took a bottle of water up next to a chain link fence to give this lion water, and then I touch it on its head. I've got a picture of me touching on it. What an idiot thing to do, right? It pulled me through the chain link fence. But I thought I was going to die. Not from that. I ended up getting upper respiratory infection from our 5-star hotel that we stayed at. There was black mold in the wall, and so I got a real bad, you know, infection. And we didn't have the antibiotics that I needed. So I had to wait. I remember 4 days for this medication to arrive before I could even start the process. But again, amazing experience to know that. And that's when I was converting to the flight side. I was pressured by, you know, we were losing guys, and I had become really, really, you know, a great squad leader and leader. And so they're like, you got to come on to flight. I was like, man, I don't want to fly. I didn't think I wanted to fly. But having a couple flights there, it was like, this is pretty cool. This is cool. And just watching, you know, us at the time we were there, we were moving, you know, doctors. We were, allowing individuals there, locals that had never seen like a doctor or been given any kind of, you know, attention medically, an opportunity to like make friends, and see like who we are and how we're there, you know, we're there to help. So just, again, firsthand seeing that, believing it, feeling that, it was motivating, inspirational, and it made me feel good about what I was doing, but, you know, being there with the United States in Africa.
Well, you mentioned about getting into the flying side. So talk to me about the role. What is a hooker? And then, you know, what were the kind of roles and responsibilities within the aircraft?
Yeah. So I will say part of my my injury, part of my therapy was they would go through like PID, identifying parts of the helicopter. And because that was something I did. I did that for 9 years. And I couldn't recall. I'm like, I would say, if you gave me a multiple choice, I could pick the answer, but retrieving it and trying to remember the name of it, I can't get it. It's so nerve, you know, it's depressing at times because it's very frustrating to be able to do that. But basically it's RL progression. You progress, through multiple steps until you become a flight engineer. And, just learning, calling sling loads, learning the parts of emergency procedures, memorizing everything like that. Basically, they would say that it's our helicopter. We just let the pilots fly it. And you believe that whenever it's time for we're done flying for a certain amount of time, and then the pilots get off and they go walk away. You sit there and clean up and take care of the rest. But it's part of it. You know what I mean? It's crew coordination. It's learning how to communicate. Again, I think it's an awesome way to learn how to communicate in real life too, you know, in the civilian side, because they can't see and you can't, and you're trusting each other. You know, everything is within each other and those guys next to you. So just learning the process, understanding the process, was a cool experience. Very difficult. It's not for everybody, but so the hooker, that's what everybody in the Chinook community, that's what they call it. They call us hookers. There's three sling loads, and obviously they, you know, they're there for multiple reasons, but man, it's the horse. It's the fastest helicopter. To me, I'm obviously biased, but it's the coolest helicopter. I think everybody wants to be in that community. I think, right. Cause I was in it. I didn't want to be a Black Hawk guy. No offense to anybody else, but I didn't, that wasn't like a dream of mine. You know what I mean? So like to be in the Chinook side, I'm lucky that I got to experience that.
So what was the difference? I mean, obviously now you're in the air, but apart from that, what was the difference about the second Afghanistan deployment prior to the crash?
Flying for sure. And it being the first deployment, I was a maintainer working nights, some days, but mostly nights working. So being on the ground at the hangar and listening in to the radio chatter, right? The second deployment is I'm actually flying and I'm in it. And I remember every night being stressful, every day being stressful, and scary. I'm not afraid to say that. Like I was afraid for my life multiple times flying. We were at a shank. That's where we were, in the second deployment. And it was a bad place to be. It was scary as hell. And then just getting hit, you know, our flight line was getting hit with IDF, and then it was real war, you know what I mean? I think people are maybe too tough to talk of it like that, but I was in it, and I was injured. And so my whole mindset, my perspective changes in incredibly because of that.
I heard you again in the documentary, credit to them, and it was, as you said, a really well-made piece of film as well. Explain to me the labeling of Extortion 17. Obviously, that is known for a tragic incident that happened later on, but explain to me the kind of labeling so people understand that.
Yeah, I get this is such a sensitive topic, and I it's hard for me to explain it for multiple reasons. I get emotional even thinking about it because it's something I don't even want to be attached to, right? It's not like I'm trying to be something I'm not. It's something I'm attached to, and I feel like it's my duty. I'm wearing a shirt right here that represents it, 31 Heroes, but it's real. So Extortion is a call sign that we created when our group got there. Our unit was there, and I remember sitting talking, and we were all like voting on what was going to be our call sign, our you know, the name, and Extortion is what was voted on, and the 17 number from, and again, I'm retelling somebody else's terms because I don't recall it exactly, but from my understanding, it's the 17 is how many ships are out that night, and then the number, the first number, so there was like 7, I guess, is what at least 7, and then the number 1 is the order of, like, we had Buddy Lee was the pilot, and he was our FOB commander, like, for our unit, so he was number 1 in order, and so from my understanding, we originally manifested as Extortion 16, and I guess they changed at any given time. There were changes, and so we did take off as 17, and so that was our call sign for that flight. Would mean nothing at all if it wasn't for this other helicopter crash. By the way, there wouldn't be that meaning there because in our crash, no one died. Although there were, we'll get to that point. And the meaning behind that is also that they didn't retire the call sign because no one died. And then what are the chances it happens again with the same exact call sign? I don't think anybody expected something like that to happen. But to live with it and to there's such a connection, and it's a sensitive connection to so many different people, individuals that are attached to that lost people, that knew people, that friends and family in the United States. And then you bring in me, who's a survivor, essentially, and a miracle, a miraculous, you know, recovery. And then I'm walking around, I'm traveling, telling my story, and I talk about this, and people look at me as if I'm trying to be somebody I'm not, essentially. And it's like, because they don't know there was a first Extortion 17 crash, right? That's what's crazy. Like, I'm trying to prove to people that this actually happened, that I'm the guy that everyone thought died on the ramp. And it's difficult. It's difficult because I don't want to be that person. I don't even want to be, like, just eliminate Extortion 17 altogether for me when I talk, right? And just look at, I'm a human being. I was a soldier and I was in a helicopter crash, and look at my recovery, right? I don't need to be attached to something I'm not. It's just, so it's hard coming from me, from my mouth, when people have different views, especially being a reservist, right? And you've got the active duty guys that were there that were like, well, they were just reservist. And so they minimize it again like it's a contest. I don't like contests. I'm not like that, okay? So if you have to feel that, then you feel that. But it gets really nerve-wracking trying to – it becomes emotional. It's like, man, I'm just doing me, right? I'm just trying to be the best person I can, but also honor the fallen so that they're never forgotten.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that we're having this conversation because firstly, people now can understand that. Secondly, you mentioned Buddy. He was killed. Brian Nichols was killed, wasn't he? He was on your crew and then killed in the second one. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So, these all tie in together. So I think it's important that we, you know, the layman do understand exactly what the difference was and what happened between each of those two events.
Yeah. I appreciate the platform and the willingness, the fact that you even understand most of this because you've already watched it. I really appreciate that. It means a whole heck of a lot. I need help communicating things, and I'm transparent, you know, enough to admit that too, that I have a hard time. So any kind of assistance there is extremely helpful, and and grace. We all need grace, and I need a lot of it. You know, Brian Nichols is in the first crash. He was actually from our Gardner unit. So I flew with him all the time. And what are the chances that he's also on the second crash? And he was supposed to come see me. I was in the hospital. I'd made it to Minneapolis, Minnesota, and he was talking to my wife at that time. His wife and my wife were talking because he wanted to come back and see me. He had my helmet and my my tail that he was going to bring back to me. And I just remember in the hospital seeing the news. I got released to the Fisher House. That's where she was staying. And I saw the newspaper with the Chinook on the front of it. I think it said UN. It was a UN bird. And I go, what? It was confusing to me because it didn't make sense for obvious reasons. But they all were trying to hide it from me because they were afraid I was going to, you know, plummet on my recovery because I was making huge gains and progressing. And so just seeing that, and finally, because I was making so much of a big deal about it, and finally they, you know, Kirk was the guy that was on the board of me as well. He was my mentor. And I finally got on the phone with him because he was the other guy that got medevaced with me. And I remember being on the phone with him, and he was like, yeah, that was our guys. And it sucked because all the support I was getting from all the, you know, our unit, the family members as well, all of a sudden it felt like it didn't matter about me anymore. And I took myself out of that as well, right? I was like, my recovery doesn't matter at this point because it's on everybody else, because and the family members that are there, because these guys are gone now. It's tough.
Well, let's get to your one, because I mean, I can just imagine, you know, you're recovering from that and this happens, and I'm sure there's a kind of survivor's guilt element to it, even though these obviously were two separate groups of people. But, you know, the fact that you selflessly in the middle of your recovery felt like, you know, all of a sudden I don't deserve this attention, you know, speaks to, again, that selflessness that you have, the selflessness that you have. But this is, you know, that brotherhood and sisterhood that, you know, we have in the first responder professions, you have in the military. But let's get to your event, because it was significant. And yes, you did not die, but you've had a lifelong change, you know, in your physicality and in your cognition now. So June 25th, 2011, talk to me about, you know, the workup for that, you know, what you were supposed to be doing. And then let's talk about the event itself.
Yeah, so I remember they had a meeting and brought us in, and they said, we're going to go on this 5-day mission to Jalalabad, infill, exfill, resupply, move some guys around. And so I remember then they pulled me. They said, you know, we're going to call ourselves the A-Team. And I felt really good about that. I was like, man, these guys believe in me, and I'm making a lot of gains and progressing, and I'm doing the right things, and I felt good about it. And being at Jalalabad, I remember the night we got there, the AC in our tent went out, and we were just up all day. And they finally moved us to a different building, but just the time consumption, just we're supposed to be sleeping, right, prepping to fly, and just being up, couldn't sleep, so hot. Finally got to a place and was like, okay, as soon as we got it, our eyes closed, we were awake again. And then they called us. We went to the chow hall to get some food. And they had the meeting, the briefing. And I remember it was the weirdest, craziest thing, because it was a young female. I remember saying we were supposed to, like, there should have always been like an NCO that briefed us. And I feel like it was a PFC. It was a female PFC that briefed us. The room was empty. It was just us, and we're sitting there going, this doesn't make sense. It was just very like casual. Here's your stuff. Here's your notes, and go on your way. And so we went back out to the flight line after, and started getting everything, you know, ready to go. And Buddy said, "Hey, let's get a picture." And we never took pictures. I don't know, just the way that all these things, the steps, and how this happened, worked out. we never took pictures, and I had a camera in my, you know, my uniform, in my leg, the pants, and we snapped a couple photos, and that's the photo use that's out there that's been used for both crashes, and where Buddy, or you know, where Brian's on the far left, and you got was it Bunny, Brooks, then Kuykendall and myself. I think Kuykendall was second, but either way, the all five of us on the ramp, and then. And then we loaded up, took off, and we went to pick up a bunch of ground guys, infantry guys, and which I've reconnected with them to this day. I reconnected with a bunch of them. And we went and we were supposed to drop them in, do an infill. And I remember we did a go-around. I was on the ramp. It was windy, and the terrain we were going into was not flat. It was terrible. I've got photos from the out, you know, a few clicks out from an aerial, you know, view, and like it's the whole side of a, you know, a mountain, trees everywhere, and then you see the helicopter where we landed. It's insane that no one was killed in that. I remember calling the trees for clearance. Basically trees, and then going over the, I'm on the ramp looking back at the 6 o'clock position. And so when we make it over, the blades are here, and I'm like, okay, you're clear of the trees. You're clear to come down. So I called clear to come down. I remember saying, whether I lost ICS communication, I don't know, but I remember saying, RPG 6 o'clock position, coming from the number two side, right? I thought it missed us. And then I called small arms. I thought that also missed us. So I didn't even know that any of that happened until I've been retold these things looking back. So, and then the ground guys have statements where they heard it. They said that they heard us getting, you know, small arms. Either way, we lost the number two engine, and that's the direction it was coming in. But that's the last thing I actually like somewhat I'm confident about saying for myself. After that, we drop straight down. There's a recapture, a recount of Buddy's, you know, view of this. And there's a book called The Final Mission of Extortion 1-7. That's about the heroes of the other crash, the true heroes, right? And because I'm part of the story, there's a recount of my crash in chapter 11. And Buddy talks about him and Brian Nichols and how they went and how Buddy just kept flying. And that's why I'm grateful for them, because of having a couple of amazing pilots that we landed it perfectly flat on that crazy ass terrain. And the fact that the aircraft did what it was supposed to do, the ass pylon rotated around, but it's like a can opener just peeled up the entire, you know, top of the airframe. The fact that no one was killed in any of that is insane. And I have my helmet, and there's a straight, which is crazy to me to try to wonder what was that. There's a straight line within the Kevlar of where I hit something. I don't know what would have been that straight within the aircraft other than a blade, but I wouldn't have a head right now. I don't know, unless it was the ramp, but it would have been the side of the ramp. On the outside, I don't know. Either way, I hit the right side of my head, and that affects the opposite side of the body. So my whole left side, I lost motor skill, function. I'm knocked unconscious, and I have a statements from the guys that were coming off the ramp, all walking over me. AJ Bedoy was the guy that was two from me on the right side, on the number two side. Looking facing forward, and he said, you know, he remembered watching me as we were going down, and then I'm unconscious. Once he gets up, he said that he looked at me and he's like, Zeke's dead. And he said he walked over me. And the first time I reconnected with him like a few years ago, and he lost it. He broke down. He was like, man, I thought you were dead. I'm sorry. But it's, you know, he's got nothing to be sorry about, right? Because he had a new mission at that point. He he needed to take care, you know, and do what he's supposed to do. So get off, make sure you clear, take care of your guys, pull security, get a perimeter, all those things that need to happen. So I had to reassure him, but man, let that guilt go right off the bat, because, you know, because of you guys, I'm actually here live today. You know what I mean? I wouldn't have been medevac the way I need to be, you know, gotten out of there. So, it's crazy that I even still go through this process of reliving it and retelling it. And it's just as painful now as it is every other time when I talk about it, you know? It's like it was yesterday, but I don't speak the language like I did yesterday. I don't speak the military, you know, jargon. I have a hard time recalling the things that it's supposed to. It's not as smooth as reading a book. You know what I mean? I'm vomiting basically what I can put together in words to try to express it.
You're way more articulate than I think you give yourself credit for, just so you know. You're coming through very, very clearly. So I'm sure it seems garbled to you, you know, compared to, like you said, when you didn't have the TBI, but, you know, you're storytelling perfectly, just so you know.
I appreciate you saying that. Well, I guess the funny part about that, I'll make it funny anyway, is that when I was in the hospital, I remember the doctor came over and he was talking to Lacey and myself, and he said, or she said, you had a high IQ before, and so now you're just a regular guy. You're just average now. I was like, damn. So I don't have a high IQ anymore. But I think that maybe that's part of it, of how I have bounced back and why I'm so articulate. Like I want to be very descriptive and be very truthful and honest about every detail that I have, that I give. I just have a hard time putting it together, like most people do. Some people do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I've got a low IQ, so I can tell you, I live fine with it.
Oh, I doubt that. I know better. But thank you for trying to make me feel better. I see what you did there.
So let's talk about after then. So firstly, you know, what did the rescue look like? I mean, what have you heard as far as, you know, realizing you weren't dead, and then the medevac crew, and then getting you to, was it Bagram that you went to initially?
Yes, Bagram, and then I was moved to Germany, Landstuhl. So just looking back and from what what people have told me about what happened is that when they found me, they thought I was dead. But so then they moved me away from the, that's what they did. They said they could hear me. Like I was choking. I had blood coming out of my ear. They split in my left leg. Because they thought I broke it. It was, dislocated, whatever. But really it was because of I lost motor skill function. So it just was like all over the place. Regardless, they splinted me, wrapped me up. And then they moved me because they could hear me like choking essentially. And then once they got me moved, I was like agonizing pain, screaming, yelling, whatever it was. I don't know. Just what they've told me. And so then they called in. I only flew and crewed a 47 D helicopter airframe. And so I never got to fly on the new Foxtrot models. I guess it's all avionics. And so that was my medevac aircraft, was the newer model aircraft, Chinooks. And so they pulled me out, and then Kirk Eichendahl, he was on the right gun. He was, all the guys, I guess, on the right side, number two side, did like a domino effect, and they all fell on him, and his leg was snapped. And so him and I were medevaced out together to Bagram, and then onto Landstuhl. And I don't recall his path, Kirk's path, but I know that I had to become stable enough for them to allow me to be moved stateside to Walter Reed, Bethesda, Maryland. It's when they were merging, the two hospitals were merging together there. I don't have a view of it, a visual of it, so therefore I don't understand what it looks like. So all I know, to me, it's Walter Reed's on one side and Bethesda Naval is on the other side, and they're just like merging together. That's all I can't see it any other way than that. So that's where I was moved. I was in a coma for a little over 2 weeks. it's hard to recall a lot of things. I remember having a lot of dreams and having a feeding tube, doing certain things, having certain things. The room, I'll talk to Lacey at times and try to get hers, but I feel like she's been, you know, traumatized in her own way from all that she's experienced with that. So I don't feel like I can talk to her and ask too many things without upsetting her. I don't really have any answers for what happened at that point. Waking up, I remember they moved me from Bethesda to Minneapolis, Minnesota, to the hospital, the VA hospital there. And I remember there being a short bus on the runway there at Bethesda, a short school bus, a small one that they turned into an ambulance essentially. And I remember waiting in a wheelchair. It was real cold, sitting there, and they're like, okay, we're going to have to wait, but we're going to take you out there to the plane. It was a tiny ass jet. So I can't, maybe somebody else out there who's been through something traumatic like this can understand me, but knowing I'm about to get onto a plane after my experience up on the helicopter, right? Knowing it's going to happen, and then knowing it's so tiny, I already was like working myself up, but also still, it's like, I'm still halfway coherent and not probably medication, probably the trauma to the head. For reference, the injury that I sustained was a traumatic brain injury, diffuse axonal. And so head injuries are rated from 3 to 15. 15 is like a concussion. 3 is your brain dead. I was rated a 7. So I was already written off fairly, you know, in the very beginning as to what kind of recovery looked like. That when I did wake up, how coherent would I be? What level would I be? It wasn't good. None of it was good. The prognosis were nothing was wonderful to expect. And so having to endure those things that I did in the beginning were on top of being scary. It was confusing. And so, on the flight, I remember I pissed myself. There's a picture where they shaved half of my head because they had to clear off the area my head for the vent and whatever the stuff's called. I had staples in my head. I had a deal to release the fluid here and back here, but they didn't cut my whole head, I guess, because they were afraid of any kind of cuts and bleeding and things like that. So they just had to cut what they needed to cut. So I look like a fool in a couple of the photos. I'm like, come on, dress me up something, right? But just that flight was very stressful. And then once we got to Minneapolis, the in processing and get situated, I was alone at that point in my room on the bed. And I remember just being so alone and hearing. A lot of other guys. Just the noises, the yells, the screams, just being afraid and terrified, you know. Again, it took me back to, and I'm aware of this, it took me back to a time whenever I was a young kid living in that town of 45 people and being by myself and not having anybody to rely on or who's going to protect me, who's going to save me, who's going to help me, right? And so I would, just going to that little spot and just, you know, tell myself, you got to get out of here. Nobody else can do it for you, you know? And that's why I locked in. And I just, going from being told you're not going to get out of here, you may not walk, you know what I mean? You may not talk, all these different things. And within 4 months, I was out of the hospital, going back home. It was so miraculous that even TV stations back in Kansas City were coming up to do videos and, you know, stories on it, because they're like, this doesn't happen. The doctors, you know, did interviews and they're like, this doesn't happen. Again, it's tough to put into words. But I give a lot of grace or a lot of credit to, you know, God. I believe that's a huge part of my story and my recovery. I credit myself, you know, the doctors, the nurses, the medical staff, amazing, because that's a big part of them doing their job. And then I do credit myself at times, and you know how hard I worked, and just the resiliency and the drive that I just, even today, to get up out of bed in pain and all the shit I deal with. I think it's just how I've been created, I suppose. I don't know. I don't like excuses. I might talk about them and complain about them, but I just feel like I'm supposed to do what I'm supposed to do, you know?
What about mentally and emotionally, even veterans and first responders that haven't been injured at all, just gone through their career, you know, being successful, but then transition out, whether it's, you know, they were fired, discharged, whether they were hurt, whether they promoted sometimes even out of their unit to a desk. You see so many people struggle with that transition. Now, when you are hurt and you had that snatch from you and even your own physicality has been changed, I can imagine that's, you know, extremely jarring. So did you find yourself at a low point? And if so, what were some of the things that pulled you out of that?
Yeah, I did. I used to be like a perfectionist. I still think I am, although I'm just more aware of the fact that I can't be. So I have to just kind of like work through that. But I used to be such a perfectionist. I wanted to be good at everything I did, because I was fairly good at whatever I did. Because the more I put my mind to it, I focus in, I dial in, I become better at it. So, and I've done, you know, speeches to different, you know, groups of people, or presentations, I should say. I feel like I'm a terrible speaker. I'm just a real authentic person, so people can relate to me in that sense, right? You talk about transitioning, things like that, we like to talk about like fulfilling our resumes full of things that we're good at, and like knowing our best qualities, right? For me personally, right, I like to point out the things that I know I'm not good at. So I can help things in a lot of different ways, but knowing that when I got hurt, I wasn't good at something. That's where my focus went to, is what are my weakest links, my poorest traits? What can I do? How can I make those better? And I remember sitting in the hospital room, right? My left side paralyzed like this. There's pictures of me. Let me turn this way. Like this. That's how I was locked in, my whole left side. And I couldn't, I'm left side dominant, by the way. And so my hand, I couldn't pull it out very well. I couldn't, you know, it's tight at some spots, but all these, so I say that to say like, that was a poor quality of mine at the time. I would get so frustrated. I couldn't do certain things. So I remember asking for puzzles. I liked puzzles. And I asked the nurses, you know, do you have puzzles? Can you give me puzzles? And so I would sit there and have a tray on the bed. Mind you, I tried to get out of the bed many times. I became like this guy that always tried to bail from the hospital bed, and so I had to put a beeper on my bed because I kept trying to get up and get out. Like I could just do this on my own, right? But they would bring me in a tray with puzzles, and again, my thought is, what's my weakest link? So my right arm, I'm left hand side up, my right arm's not even that great, but that's the arm I'm doing the puzzle with. And then I'm like, well, wait, this isn't going to get better on its own. So I couldn't even hold my arm up on my own. So, example, go to the fridge, grab a carton of milk or a jug of milk and pull it out. Okay. This arm, got it. This arm, I drop it. It's like I had a stroke. So all those muscles within, I couldn't hold them. So sitting there doing a puzzle on the bed, I would grab a piece and hold my arm, which brought me to that point. It's almost as if I was prepared for the worst possible, scenario. And because of that, I was able to have all these things that helped me through the process. I have to think of it like that. I don't have to, but I choose to think of it like that because it helps me make sense of it, right? That if I wasn't at my best, if I wasn't in the best shape, scenario, prepared for that, I wouldn't be here today anyway, you know?
Well, you mentioned at the beginning about your love of art when you were young. Talk to me about finding beer caps, beer bottle caps at the end of a party, and how that led to, you know, the art that you create these days.
So I didn't pursue it in that way. Essentially, like whenever I got home, I had a very difficult time with people. I'm a very big people person, but once I'm home, And then, you know, the other crash happens, and people would come up and ask me the craziest questions, and I'd be like, this is not okay. I don't think they meant to talk to me, they did, but I couldn't handle it. And so I got a lake lot with a camper and a pontoon boat, just a place to get away on the weekends and just kind of just be alone, I guess, sometimes. And I had a buddy help me put together a table, and it was like from an old wire spool, you know, that they use on construction sites, like the old wire spool. Turned it into a table. It's sitting next to the camper. He helps me. I say helps me as if I did anything at all, because I couldn't do much of anything. But he built a deck right there next to the camper. And I took a hammer to it. We went to go put it back in the trailer. And I walked by the table that was built, the wire spool table. And that's where everybody threw their beer caps, just laying there on the table. And I walked by and went to go hit a bottle cap with the hammer, and I missed. And again, being a perfectionist, I used to do construction. I was a roofer of sheet metal, so I used the hammer all the time. And I was like, what the heck, man? And so it made me angry. So I stood there, I kept trying to hit it. Kept trying to hit the same spot over and over, because the bottle cap is 1 inch in diameter. And I kept trying to hit the same spot. And all these bottle caps, hundreds of bottle caps, and that's what happened. So the longer I stood there, the more I kept doing it, I kept realizing I got better at it. My hand-eye coordination, my motor skills, all these things I'm doing to improve and help myself, like my weakest link, right? And I'm sitting here now learning how to improve this on my own by doing this. So I focus and give all my attention. I end up smashing all these bottle caps flat, and I nail them to the wire spool table. It was so cool. I've got a picture. It's on my page. But actually, I might have a picture right here. I don't. It's going to take too much time. Anyway, it's online. You can find it on that Instagram. But I smashed all these bottle caps, nailed them, went home, came back the next week. It had rained. What happens when a bottle cap gets wet? It rusts. So that whole table was rusted out. Looking back, I wish I still had it, because that thing would have been so freaking cool. But then it went to the trash can. And then my mind started working more. I'm like, well, I need to work with bottle caps because that helps me. So then I was like, well, can I make a different design? How can I preserve these, make them where I can keep this artwork, essentially, is what it was. So I got into epoxies, learned that all epoxy yellows over time, resins. And so now I use a product called Art Resin. So as you asked the question how I got to this, so that's what happened. So I didn't realize it was even artistic until I got to the point where it's like, I could do better than that. And so I started making different designs. I had the hand tools of roofing and sheet metal, so I started taking my snips and cutting the bottle caps and bending them into the shapes to perfect the design. And as you can see behind me, those are bottle cap things that I've done with epoxy resin. And excuse me. And so then it became a passion when people are like, dude, what can I buy one of these? And then it's like, can you donate one of these to this auction that we're having for a fundraiser? To raise money for veterans and things like that. And it's like, along the way, I kept getting better. And along the way, I kept realizing no one does it like this. So being unique, one of a kind, and then my story would attach onto it. And they're like, dude, Zeke, he was hurt like this, but now he's making art and he can do this and help other people. Then it was like positive reinforcement, using my heart, being good and giving back and helping other people that are hurting, that need that help like I needed, right? So just, it's so impactful and it's rewarding. The only hard part about it is reliving it every time I talk about it. You know what I mean? It's very difficult. It's challenging, but the positives that come back are, I feel like, are greater than the negatives I feel or the struggles I feel along the way.
When I think about what it would take to flatten caps, certainly to arrange them in a way that it makes an American flag, I think again about someone with the attention to detail and that perfectionism. Has that allowed you to kind of tap into that perfectionism that you had prior to the injury by the sheer accuracy needed for some of these pieces of art?
It's almost like I have OCD because they all have to be faced the same direction or a little bit cocked. But I will say, when I'm in the right mindset of what it's supposed to be for me, it's healing, right? It forces me to calm down. When I'm stressed out and I'm freaking out and my brain is moving so fast, I can't walk up and start just doing this and be as articulate as I want to be, right? I start making a mess of that, and it's not good. It's not great. So then it forces me to stop, calm myself, you know, and just very, very carefully move things. And it's still to this day a chance for me to still work on my arm, my motor skills, because I can't just walk over and use my hand and get cocky and be like, oh, let me knock this out. Because then my whole hand moves into it. Like, I just, like, it's like a stiff arm that just kind of pushes everything. So I still have to, like, be there and be very carefully. They're normal struggles that I have because of what I've experienced. But it is, I understand that it is and it can be very rewarding and helpful in the process.
From an emotional point of view, again, that transition, whether it's with injury, whether it's not, you know, one of the things that we do in uniform is we have purpose. You know, a lot of us are doing this to make the world a little bit better. And then you transition out and that's kind of taken from you, you know, initially in that role. But the number of people I know that one of the parts of a healthy transition is they found another way to give, another way to make the world a little bit better. Did this kind of project start putting some of that purpose back in for you?
Yeah, I think that you just said it right there. It's exactly what it is. It's the servant side of things. When you reflecting on all the things you asked me about like in my service, being in Pakistan, being in Africa, being in Afghanistan, seeing what the service there, what it was doing, the impacts, it's giving, it's serving, it's giving back. Feeling like you have a purpose behind what you're doing, and, you know, other than just like serving, you're serving yourself and your country. And then finding the purpose that I had, like I said in the documentary, you know, I thought I was a lifer. I thought that was like my purpose was to be in the military and continue to serve to the full extent. And then, you know, once I get hurt, I get, you know, medically retired. What am I supposed to do now? So that's where the drive is for me, is seeing that this has a purpose. I have a purpose. People value my art and it auctions for an insane amount of money each time. And I get to give that back. That's going to help somebody else with whatever struggle they have going on. And that's exactly what it is. I have a servant's heart, right? It's all in good and it's pure and it's supposed to be successful for other people as well. And that's where it fills my cup. You know what I mean? I'm lucky to have that, because a lot of people don't have they don't necessarily have that, or they don't find that until, you know, later in life and after they struggle along the way. And the fact that I this fell into my lap and to realize how you know, impactful it can be now, it's I'm grateful to have it, you know.
What about psychedelics? I've had a lot of people on here, even just from the mental health journey, they found it extremely beneficial. Some of them, you know, really turned a corner in addiction, all kinds of things. Others, you know, it opened doors and then they carried on working on that with therapists. But the other side you also hear about is that psilocybin seems to be one of the only substances that they're aware of at the moment that are actually helping nerves regrow, regenerate. So have you explored that path at all?
So a little over a year ago, I was doing an event with Captain Phillips, Captain Rich Phillips, and some Navy SEALs. Jeff Bull was one of the rescuers, the Navy SEALs, one of the shooters that rescued Captain Phillips. He approached me after I presented there, and amazing human being, by the way, and he brought to my attention ketamine under doctor supervision. And I was like hesitant, and I'm like, you know what, whatever might help and kind of calm me down, things like that, and just reset my mind. And then the guy that purchased my artwork, approached me and said he would sponsor and basically cover the expense for this, for me to experience that. Amazing human beings, and just the opportunity to experience that and give it a chance was a blessing. So I went through 6 sessions with that, and it did exactly that. It calmed me down. It kind of chilled me up almost too much, I think, because I'm such an active person where I've got to force myself, not really force myself, but I want to force myself to do things, keep moving. I have a hard time sitting still. If I'm sitting still, it's not a good thing. Like that means I'm not good mentally. But I went through 6 sessions, and the whole day I'm out in then there, like it's trippy for sure. I killed myself twice in one of the sessions. I painted myself into a wall. The other one, I went deep sea fishing and jumped in the water. Instead of drowning, I just started chugging the water to drink myself as fast as I could. Just insane things. But the overall response was I did feel calmer, And more, I feel like I was in more control of my thoughts afterwards. Maybe more creative for the time being. Some other things happened within that as well. They weren't so good, and that's kind of pulled me away from it just a little bit. And that's more of a personal view on it. But overall, that's kind of, I've been approached with other things too, like within the shrooms. I don't know. Like I did zero drugs when I was growing up. You know, I did get my marijuana card here. But even then it's just like the CBD and the things that the gummies, like things like that to like put me to bed, to calm me down so I get tired. I don't dabble a whole lot in anything else because I don't, maybe because I'm just ignorant, or I'm new, or I'm I also have kids, and maybe that's part of it as well. I want to help myself, but I don't want to take away any kind of motivation I have with what I'm doing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I mean, from what I've heard, and again, I haven't done it. Well, I take that back. I did it recreationally in Japan, so I have done it. But a lot of times from psilocybin, I hear people say they get more focused if they're doing the microdosing. But again, it's also just that reoccurring thing that, yes, the journeys, you know, find them healing as well. But it's the excitement that this also seems to help with neurogenesis, with the regrowing of nerves and TBIs especially. So it would be interesting, you know, not even going down the path, but having, if the microdosing is helping from a brain health point of view, where you're still, you know, you're sharp, but you're not going on some journey on it, that maybe that would be another tool in the toolbox down the road.
Yeah, I'm open to anything. I've always said it. I've always, anything that's been brought to me, I'm like, what's the worst thing that could happen? I'll give this a try, see what can, you know, how it can help. I'm definitely open to it. I've been offered service dogs multiple times. I will have a service dog at one point. I'll accept any of these things. I've been, something else, there's a deal down in Mexico, I think, where they've, you take, I think it's the microdosing as well. I'm not entirely familiar with it. I've just been approached with the idea, the concept, and it's hard to find time to make those things happen with. I have a busy schedule with traveling, the events, kids, regular life. So it's hard to find an extra week essentially to go off and say, let me go try this out, see what happens. I feel like it is a priority. It's at a point I need to do something about that fairly soon, sooner than later anyway, just because of my mental health struggles have declined essentially in the last, I would say 14, 15 months. So I need to find something to help keep me going and bring me back, you know, back up.
Brilliant. Well, I mean, I have some people that I think, you know, we could connect you with. Doesn't mean that it'd have to be any sort of, you know, movement on that. But I think, cause there's such a spectrum, and this is what I'm realizing now. I'm still new to this too, but there's the very, very gentle, there's the micro dosing, there's the things where you just, it's almost like supplementation all the way through to, you know, Ibogaine, which is the one that you hear a lot of the SEALs go to, which is the nuclear option. You know, if you've got crippling addiction, then that will basically cause a 48-hour purge. But then the other end of that, you know, you're healing again. So there's so many, I think, you know, in this tool chest that people don't talk about, that you can actually find, okay, well, I don't want to commit to, you know, this nuclear option, but maybe this microdosing would help, you know, and see what happens. And then again, if you've got TBI, maybe, just maybe, and I'm just, you know, hypothesizing, that maybe some of these plant medicines will take you on a journey where you can unlock some of these memories that were kept away from you because of the damage.
Right. And maybe that's a subconscious fear that I have, and that's why I've avoided it. I don't know. Because I don't know how I would handle it, right? And even the things that I have gone through, and I recall certain things, even then it's a matter of, is this what I'm recalling actually, or is this something somebody told me, and I'm just remembering that memory that they told me about it. So it's very misleading for me, and it's difficult to understand or know, is this really what happened? Is this really how that happened? At some point, I'm ready to just, you know, face it head on and do it. It's interesting you say that, though, because the two different options I've been presented have come from Navy SEALs. I've done a lot of work with them and been alongside at fundraising, you know, fundraisers and auctions and things like that. So maybe we're talking about similar situations here, but I'd love to talk to you offline about those opportunities, though, for sure, James.
Absolutely. All right. I want to hit one more topic and then we'll go to some closing questions. But I had, speaking of your brother being a Marine, I had an amazing man, Major James Capers, and he was one of the founding members of Recon Marines and did this, you know, heroic. I mean, it was obviously multiple men, but part of this incredible rescue in Vietnam. He was really badly wounded. And to this day, they're still trying to get him the Medal of Honor. Now, you obviously, there's a kind of assumption that if you do certain things or if you get hurt, that it would be kind of an automatic thing. But obviously, this isn't the case. So I saw when I was researching you, you weren't initially awarded a Purple Heart. So talk to me about that journey and who helped you achieve that.
So that's, that was difficult because being in the hospital, I'm watching all these guys around me receiving the Purple Hearts, and I was confused because I thought, what did I do wrong? I put a lot of it on me just being confused after like trying to wake up from being out and talking to the guys in my unit and saying like, what happened? Somebody tell me what happened. Like, I kept thinking it was on me. Like, I made a mistake and that's why we were there. It was confusing. I didn't understand. And then, looking back and through it, the way that they talked about the investigation, how that was done. Again, they talked about how there was an active duty component and then the reserve unit component and how that was easy to pin it on, you know, the reserve. So just the investigation of the crash and how what happened was inconclusive. They said that it was either a pilot error or mechanical failure or a crew mistake, pilot error, things like that. And it was like, they started pinging on saying it was an accident. It wasn't combat related, or it wasn't we weren't being fired at, something like that. Like, the tree strike was a big thing they talked about, and I'm like, but the tree strike was secondary. That's not what took us down. And even then, when you saw the trees and a full investigation, the blade just went straight through the tree anyway. So all these different things, all these different factors came into play, and it became to the point where it's like, you know what, I'm in the back of the helicopter. Are we not in combat? I was confused. It was so misunderstanding, inconclusive to me as to what the reasoning was behind that, and how we had to like make an excuse to accept this to happen when so many different variables were in the mix. And so, so in the beginning they called it an accident, a pilot error, and then years later, I went back and found the crew guys, or the ground guys that were on board. 2013, they approved it. So it was in 2011, but 2013, they approved it. That was my commander. Lacey helped with that. And then the Congressman Yoder in Kansas, they all together put that through, and then they approved it for myself and Kurt Heikendahl. Because there was... like there was obvious reasons for that to be approved, but there was a delay that was misunderstood, so confusing. But then I contacted the ground guys, the active duty guys, and they hadn't got theirs for years, and they were like, what the hell? And they kept trying to put it in as individuals, and it wasn't happening. And so I kept pushing this. I fought for them. I was their voice for years, trying to find the next person that might know somebody else. And come to find out, they were never even put in for their, because I guess their command, whoever it was, their individuals, didn't even put them in for the Purple Heart Award, because I guess the story they were told, or the assumption was, it's easier to just blame the reserve guys, the components on that. So there's so many politics within that, and I'm still to this day confused about that. I don't understand it. I don't get it. Like, you do what you do. How many guys went years without having those, reaping those benefits and from what they earned and deserved? They're just now getting their Purple Heart awarded a year ago. So that was, I don't understand it, man. Did I answer your question?
No, it does. It's just, I mean, these are really important things to hear. And like I said, with Major Capers, I don't know, even to this day, I know they were still pushing it. I know they made a documentary, and I got to sit with him in his house in South Carolina. It was amazing. But, you know, we're talking about the Vietnam War, and he still hasn't been. And that he's an African American. So back then, there is definitely a strong assumption that it was withheld because of his race. And, you know, obviously it's not the entire military, but maybe the people that were able to make that decision back then, you know. So these are the stories that need to be told. If people, you know, were in an event or, you know, had a level of heroism that needs to be recognized, because I know that there's a lot of people that spend hundreds of thousands recognizing politicians and people that haven't done a damn thing. We should make sure that our military members are recognized properly.
I've been shamed basically for being a reservist as opposed to being an active duty member. And maybe it's one of those things where it's like, look what I did. I'm tougher than you. I'm more hardcore than you. I experienced this and you didn't. And it's like, how many active duty guys weren't even deployed to combat like I was? I don't know. I don't know. Again, I told you in the beginning, I don't compare. I'm not here to fight back and forth. We all have our own path, our own story, our own reasons why, essentially, right? So thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about my reasons why. I wanted to, of course, but I didn't, right? So, but to hurt somebody else because it's easier to say reserve unit did that rather than active duty, it doesn't matter. I mean, there's still benefits that are there based off of the service and you know what we do, things like that. That's obviously was out of my control. So I'm basically waiting for the next person in line or that's above me to put in my paperwork to submit those things. And my command did that for me. And so it's hurtful to know that what could have been on the other side of that, where their command didn't take care of them and misled their own troops and withheld from them. But all along, you're playing politics and blaming the game on the reserve side. It just it's frustrating for sure, you know. And because absolutely. I'm not in a great way enough to say, hey, you were wrong, right? And to back it up because I'm not great at speaking anymore like that, it's easier just to let it go. And so I have to submit in many ways to that right there. Just let it go.
Well, I want to, like I said, get to some closing questions so I can be mindful of your time. The first one I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
Books. Well, it's interesting you say that because I used to read a lot and maybe that helped with my mind, things like that. And now it's very difficult to read. I will say that I met a former military Green Beret and at the gym, and he wants to help me. So I've been reading and he brought me a book. It's from the American Revolutionary War because I want to start back on my own. I'm not going to relearn these things if I don't do the work myself. So I told him I want to start back from the beginning and I want to read these books to reteach myself, remember, recall the information that I learned when I was in school, essentially. So I don't have a specific book to say, hey, go read this book. I just know that one that I talk about a lot is obviously The Final Mission, Extortion 1-7, because that's personal to me, and those not because of me, but because those are heroes. Those are men that are no longer here to say, "Hey, this is who I am. This is my life." And so, a wise man once told me, "Life is for the living." Right. So they're no longer here living, and so it's my job, our job to remember them, and I so that they're never forgotten. You know what I mean? So. I know you wanted me to say a good book, and I don't have a good book to give you.
No,
I
just that's a good answer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely good. I mean, to again, underline, you know, what was taken from you during that crash. I mean, this is another thing. So, you know, your journey of reading, again, I think is a great answer to that question. What about films and documentaries? Do you enjoy any of those?
I mean, I enjoy them when I'm watching them. I will say, hopefully you can remember this one. It's a film about a plane and it's students and they're flying and I want to say it's up in the mountains and then the plane splits in half and the rear falls off and the front, they crash and then there's survivors and they end up eating each other's bodies to survive. Oh man, I don't remember the name
of it. It was the one in South America, wasn't it? I forget the name of the film.
Yeah, so someone else knows that what I'm talking about. But again, there's bits and pieces. I'm not going to give it a recount appropriately. But anyway, I related so much to that because all these people, and I broke down at the end of it. I started crying like heavily because they were in survival mode and they had to eat they were conflicting with their morals and what's right, what's wrong. And but at the same time, it's like, well, if I don't do this, and then just be so disoriented, all these different things, fighting every single day to get up and go over and say, I have to fight through this, you know, to survive and to, you know, and just all the different survival mode techniques, but then also like eating another human body to continue life and feeling okay about it, right? And then at the end, going back home, and they talked about how no one would know anything about what they experienced. No one understands them. When they see them, they can walk right past somebody else and look like, oh, that's just a normal person, but nobody understands what they've been through, what they've experienced. And I hold that so dearly to myself because, and that's part of when I share my story and I speak to, you know, other people at these events, is that you have no idea what somebody else has gone through, what they've experienced. No one has any idea what the hell I experienced in my lifetime, the struggles I've had to overcome and still deal with today. But they look at me and they're like, oh, you look like an athlete or somebody that's in good shape. You must be doing wonderful in life. And you have no idea. I'm extremely sensitive. I have a hard time. I'm very honest about talking about how I have many struggles, right? And I'm not afraid to say that because I'm real, I think. It's embarrassing at times, but it's something I'd rather be honest about than lie about it. And but like, James, I'm sure you have things going on, right? You don't have to talk about them. You don't have to admit to them, but you've got things that are so significant that somebody else that even loves you and they're close to you has no idea that you're experiencing because you're good at hiding it a certain way or you're just good at not talking about it, right? And so that movie put it back in perspective to me, like someone else is trying to get the same thing I'm trying to get, to be understood, to just be understood and having somebody like give you the grace and just be a kind human being. And that's my drive every day, man, is just to be try to be a good human being for somebody else.
Beautiful. Yeah, no, I mean, to what you said, absolutely. And this is the problem, is that military first responders, when it's go time, we do have to hide our emotion. You know, like I said, if you have a horrible car crash, we can't, you know, get off the fire engine screaming, going, oh my God, there's so much blood. You know, we have to have the mask on to do the job. But then after that, you've got to remember to take the mask off and be vulnerable and process the things, whether it was on a call, whether it was at war, or whether it was at home. You know, so yep. I think this is the issue. We've got to understand we're yin and yang, not just one. What you just reminded me as well, I can't remember who it was now, but one of my guests somewhat recently met one of those survivors. They were in, I don't know if it was a museum that actually talked about it, because it was Argentina or somewhere down there. And they just happened to bump into one of those actual human beings. And they told him, you know, I forget exactly what they talked about, but they told him the story. And they were saying, if I got this right, that they had managed to process it. They'd managed to get past it and kind of forgive themselves and realize that it was a necessity. And, you know, some of the people were already deceased. So, you know, it had to be done. But, you know, you talk about overcoming trauma, you talk about post-traumatic growth. That's a pretty powerful story to have to be able to, you know, put behind you and keep living your life.
Right. Man, that's amazing. Thank you. I'm so grateful that you can recall that and relate to it, because that's something that hit me so hard. It hit me so deep. And just watching, and it because it was an aviation crash, or if it was just the whole scheme of survival, and no matter what, you have to make yourself, right? As much as you think your body's done, you still, your mind gets you, build yourself back up, and you push yourself, and you can do anything you want to, whether you want to or not. You can do anything. You don't even realize it. But then the aftermath of what you experienced, to the fact that someone can look at you and be like, you have no idea. You have no idea what the hell they had to go through to get to that point. It's just an inspirational, you know, comparison for myself.
Absolutely. Well, the next question, speaking of interesting people, is there a person that you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military, and associated professions of the world?
I need to sit on that one. I'll need to, not because I don't have somebody, but I need to, that's the part where I can't give it to you right this moment. But if you let me, send me a message and remind me of that, and I'm going to scroll through. I know I have somebody. I know a lot of people. I've come across a lot of people that experienced different things. Man, Captain Phillips would be a wonderful person as well. And he's a good dude. I bet he would. But I can look through some and see what I can find for sure.
Brilliant. When you said Captain Phillips, I wrote it down because I was like, oh, that would be it. Because he's never said it, but I'm 99% sure that one of my SEAL friends was also on that boat, you know, in that rescue. So yeah, it would be amazing to get Captain Phillips, you know, perspective as well. So, but I'll circle around with you and then we can talk about that after. So thank you. All right. Well, then the very last question before we make sure everyone knows where to find you and handicapping, what do you do to decompress?
I pace, I walk around, which is crazy. Because me sitting down, if I sit down in the couch or on the bed and I sit and I just go sigh, like decompress that way, my first thought is you could be doing something right now. Get up and do something. Because I know what it's like to sit there and not have a chance to move. Does that make sense? Like I know what it's like to be stuck in a bed or in a wheelchair and not have the ability to get up and go do what I want to do. And so that's not decompressing for me. That's relaxing and taking a moment off. But so when I get up and I walk, just walking around, I start pacing. When I'm pacing, like that's decompression for me. Mentally, it's decompressing. Whether that's decompressing my body or not, to me, mentally, that's like a good positive thing. It's like when you tell somebody they can't run, and I used to run a lot, and I have a hard time running now without hurting my feet, my legs, my hips are out. So running is difficult. It's painful, essentially. But I used to love running. That was decompressing for me. That was like relaxing. So again, walking, pacing, that's decompression for me. Experiencing, breathing in the environment, things like that.
Beautiful. When you first said pacing, I was just thinking about, you know, not being able to sit still. But when you said that, when you have been forced to sit still for a long time, you appreciate walking, that totally reframed it.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, then the very last question, if people want to learn more about you, visit, you know, the handicapping site or social media, where are the best places?
So at the moment, I'm having an issue with the website. Handicapping.org is still up, but handicapping.com is still up. The .org is the newest one. It's the same website, but the newest one, it's not linked right now for some reason. So I'm having somebody work on that. But you can Google my name, Zeke Crozier. All the links are on there. My documentary is on there. If you type in handicapping, H-A-N-D-Y, not an I, but Y-C-A-P-P-I-N, handicapping anywhere on social media, you'll find it. I've done videos on TikTok. I've done videos on Instagram. A lot of my artwork is on there as well. Facebook, LinkedIn. They're all out there. And I'm not good at marketing. And saying, hey, go find me. But if you want the inspiration of the story to see what, you know, the artwork and how I'm giving back and connecting with different organizations, it's all out there to be found. So thank you.
All right. Well, I want to say thank you so much. I mean, as you said, and I want to underline this, a lot of people that come on here and they talk about things that were traumatic to them, you know, there's an element of kind of, you know, pulling the scab off the wound, as it were. But the thousands of people that are going to hear this, I know it's going to have such an impact and it's going to have a ripple effect where it will help people. So I want to thank you firstly for your courageous vulnerability and secondly for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
James, I appreciate you saying that. And thank you for bringing me on. I love your content. I love where your mind is with these things and the fact that you give people an opportunity to share their stories and their experiences, man. You're just helping me reach my story. I don't like attention for me, but this story is powerful and inspirational, and that's the part that I'm just grateful for you to give the opportunity to put it out there.